This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we're going to take a look at the Allied battle for Sicily and Italy. Our guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and journalist Rick Atkinson. The second in his Liberation Trilogy, The Day of Battle, The War in Sicily and Italy, 1943-1944, is now out. The first book in his Liberation Trilogy was An Army at Dawn, The War in North Africa, 1942-1943. In that book, Atkinson examined the Allied victory in North Africa. The fighting in Sicily and Italy was brutal, the price for victory high. Over a period of 608 days, there were 120,000 American casualties. More than 23,000 Americans lost their lives. The number of Allied casualties totaled more than 300,000. The American estimate of German casualties, 435,000. And civilians, of course, suffered mightily. At the close of the day of battle, Atkinson includes this from Ernie Pyle. The enemy had been hard, and so had the elements. There was little solace for those who had suffered, and none at all for those who had died, in trying to rationalize about why things had happened as they did. But the liberation of Rome on June 4, 1944, signaled a turning point for the Allies. The battle for Normandy began 2 days later. Rick Atkinson was a staff writer and senior editor at the Washington Post for 20 years. His honors include Pulitzer Prizes for Journalism and History. An Army at Dawn and The Day of Battle are published by Henry Holt. You can learn more about the books and our guest, Rick Atkinson, at the Henry Holt website or at www.liberationtrilogy.com. Rick Atkinson, good to talk with you again. How are you?
Hi, Celeste. Hi, and I appreciate you having me.
Oh, my pleasure. What's it been like to have been and to continue to be immersed in all of this history of the Second World War?
What's it like?
Yeah.
Well, immersion is probably the right term. I do feel like I'm immersed in it. I've been at this project now for 8 years, two-thirds of the way done the task of writing the Liberation Trilogy. And I feel, I have to say, as if I am there with them frequently. I feel as though these men, and they are mostly men that I'm writing about, are my daily companions. I've been with them in North Africa, and we sailed together to Sicily and then to Italy, and many of them will proceed with me to France, either through the invasion of Normandy or the invasion of southern France, which was in August of 1944. And so I live and I die with them, and I think that that is part of the art of narrative writing. You try to immerse yourself in the story as vigorously as you can while maintaining the necessary scholarly perspective. One of the things that I find is that by virtue of feeling contact with them across the span of more than 60 years, I think it helps you to bring empathy to the story, to effectively walk a mile in their shoes. And you recognize, speaking of shoes, that they all have feet of clay, and it makes them more interesting. They are not the greatest generation. I don't know what that phrase means. First of all, it's more than one generation fighting World War II. You have the generation of commanders like Eisenhower, born in 1890, Patton, born in 1885, and then you have the generation of trigger pullers, born mostly in the 19-teens and the 1920s, like my father. So the notion that all the brothers were valiant and all the sisters were virtuous, I think really does them a disservice, because it's their very humanity and the fact that they all have flaws and defects and vicissitudes, as we all do, and yet struggle to overcome those and do what they need to do that really makes them extraordinary.
Yeah, lots of flesh and blood. Let's talk with a listener already who would like to speak with you, who's calling in this afternoon from Chicago on line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Rick. And I just wanted to know, is it true that when the Allies landed on Anzio, according to some of the Germans, they could have slept in Rome if they had moved right away instead of digging in? Is that true? And the second question is, have you seen Ken Burns' special on the war, and what do you think of it?
Yeah, let me answer the first one, the second one first, sir. I did see Ken Burns' special. I watched all of it. I actually reviewed it for the Washington Post. I think, you know, he did an extraordinary feat. He spent 6 years, as long as the war itself, in pulling together some remarkable footage. Even the most diligent viewer of the History Channel, I think, has not seen all of that footage that he put together. I had some issues with it. You would never know that anyone above the rank of captain had much to do with the war. It's really a worm's eye view. That's not invalid, but it's also incomplete. You know, I found that at times the pacing was not especially riveting. It could be a little boggy. But all in all, I thought it was a real asset to our understanding of the war. It was certainly very vivid in places. As far as Anzio goes, Anzio was an effort to break the logjam that had built up in central Italy. The American and British and their allies were stopped along the Gustav Line, which was the German fortifications built around the town of Cassino and stretching all the way across the peninsula of Italy. And with a firm and persistent push from Prime Minister Churchill, and Anzio was his brainstorm, there was an effort to go around the Germans and land behind them. The problem with Anzio was that it was under strength. There were two divisions, one British, one American, landed there. It was a small corps, and what you really wanted at Anzio was an army. And the decision by General Lucas, who was the American general who commanded that force, not to push inland initially has been roundly criticized for more than 60 years. He decided that he was going to build up his strength before pushing inland. Anzio is only about 25 miles from Rome. It's probably true that someone could have slept in Rome, and they would have spent the night after that in a German prison. I think that you know, even George Marshall, who was the Army Chief of Staff and rarely got involved in tactical issues, recognize that you know, for every mile you pushed inland, you increased the perimeter of your defenses by 7 miles. The Germans responded with great alacrity, as they often did. They rushed forces from all over the Mediterranean, including France and Yugoslavia, to the Anzio threat, and surrounded the beachhead. And of course, that force, which landed January 22nd, 1944. Ended up being stuck there and under artillery fire for the next 4 months. General Lucas was subsequently relieved of command in February after a German counterattack nearly threw him back into the sea. But the truth is, I think that Lucas did the right thing. I believe that if they had pushed inland, given how weak they were, how strong the German reaction was, that he would have lost his entire corps. It would have been a catastrophe. So, you know, I think technically that's right, but I think that the truth of the matter is that he acted properly.
Does the listener...
They wanted Patton to make that landing, but because of the slapping incident, it was forbidden.
Well, Patton had been the American commander in Sicily, commanded 7th Army, and the Sicily campaign lasted 6 weeks. It was quite successful, except for the fact that the four German divisions fighting there got away, almost intact. And we fight them over and over and over again up the peninsula of Italy. Patton certainly stained his copybook by slapping two soldiers, two separate incidents a week apart in August of 44. If you've seen the movie Patton, you get a pretty good idea of how at least one of those incidents unfolded. And it remained secret, this slapping incident, until November. There were 40 reporters who knew about it in the Mediterranean. They did not report it, not because they had any affection for Patton, which they mostly did not, but because they had respect for Eisenhower and didn't want to make his life harder. The story finally broke in November. The muckraker Drew Pearson broke it in Washington. He'd been tipped off by friends in the OSS. But, of course, Eisenhower knew about it almost instantly, and therefore Patton was sidelined. He sat there in Sicily through the rest of 1943, uncertain whether he was ever going to command again during the war. And Eisenhower knew, especially after the story broke and there was a huge uproar about it, that he had a problem with Patton. There were times when he wished that Patton had been his senior commander in Italy instead of Lieutenant General Mark Clark. I actually think that Patton would not have been a particularly useful commander in Italy. He was not attentive to logistics, for example. He wasn't attentive to the kind of slogging war that Italy turned into. And I think he would have been very frustrated and not particularly well suited to that. So, yeah, there were times when, a slasher like George Patton would seem to have been the right guy in Italy. But in general, I think that the way that it turned out was probably best for all concerned, including Patton.
Mm. Tell us a little bit about Patton's diary and what he wrote about his situation in Sicily.
Well, he was a very diligent diarist, thank the Lord. In fact, many of these large figures and many of the smaller figures kept diaries. The average GI was told not to because it was considered a security risk. He was at the front keeping a diary, and, of course, that was an incentive for soldiers to actually do it. Patton was dyslexic, and writing and reading at times for him were difficult, so he's got very idiosyncratic spelling, for example. But he used his diary as both a way to record what he was seeing and doing, and he had a quite keen eye. He had almost a literary eye, and you find descriptions of the springtime blooming trees in North Africa that are really quite elegant. He also used it as a way to vent, and you find him railing about the British, for example, or railing about various rivals within the army, Mark Clark being among the foremost. Mm. The diaries were subsequently published in part after he died. Patton was killed in an odd automobile accident in late 1945, shortly after the war. And they were published as a book called War as I Knew It. The entire diaries are with his papers at the Library of Congress, and I found it very useful to take a copy of the published version, and they were subsequently published almost intact by edited by Martin Blumenson, an American military historian. But if you go in and you prowl through those diaries and see what has not been published, you find very interesting tidbits. And again, they're vivid, as he was. They're profane and very useful in understanding this turbulent and emotionally unstable man. Mm-hmm.
Another interesting diary, that of Major General Jeffrey Keyes. Tell us about that.
Yes, that one has never been seen before. Jeff Keyes was West Point class of 1913. He had been a protege of sorts of Patton and always in his shadow. At West Point, it was said that Keyes was the only man, he was a football star, the only man who could stop Jim Thorpe, the great Indian athlete, on the gridiron. He was a cavalryman. He went to North Africa with Patton in 1942. He went to Sicily with Patton in 1943. He succeeded Omar Bradley as commander of the U.S. Army 2nd Corps when Bradley went back from Sicily to England to prepare for Normandy. And so Keyes is a very large figure in the campaign in Italy, particularly in 1943-1944. Keyes has been largely lost to history. He's not flamboyant. He's extraordinarily competent tactically, devout Catholic, went to Mass every morning, even in combat, and a very keen, cool customer. He's almost the antithesis of Patton in some ways. After my first book came out, An Army at Dawn, I got a phone call from Jeff Keyes' son, who's West Point class of, I think, 1946, now an elderly man living in Pittsburgh, and he said, "Did you know my father kept a diary, and would you like to see it?" Mm. And, of course, thrilled, and he flew to Dulles Airport. I live in Washington, D.C. I met him there, and he had a copy of the diary with him, and it's spare in a way that Patton's is flamboyant and voluble, but again you see what the commander is thinking at key moments. Again, it's used at times to vent, although not nearly as venomously as Patton often did. It's absolutely invaluable to me, and it helps to bring somebody like Jeff Keyes back from the dead, which is really the narrative writer's true calling, and to make him three-dimensional and to get inside him.
Mm. Journalist and historian Rick Atkinson is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. The second in his Liberation trilogy, The Day of Battle, is now out. It follows An Army at Dawn. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. So victory in North Africa, and now the Allies turn their eyes to the Mediterranean. Why did they decide on Sicily? And once Sicily was captured, why did they decide to go on to Italy?
Yes, why indeed? That question really has been asked for more than 60 years now. Sicily, Celeste, had been decided in January 1943 during the conference that was held in Casablanca, between President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill, with their military brain trusts in attendance. Sicily made a certain amount of sense after North Africa, and the campaign in North Africa ended in May of 1943 with a 250,000 German and Italian soldiers captured. They surrendered. Hitler had not allowed them to evacuate. So there is a total victory in North Africa. Sicily is about 100 miles away from the North African coast. It's only 2 miles from the mainland peninsula of Italy. And having Sicily in our possession would further safeguard shipping across the Mediterranean, particularly that to and from the Suez Canal. And it would provide air bases for bombing mainland Italy. Italy, of course, is still part of the Axis alliance with the Germans at this time, and for bombing mainland Europe, the Central Europe. What to do after Sicily was really not clear at all. The British wanted to go straight into mainland Italy. The Americans believed that this was a mistake, that, in fact, the way to win the war was to drive straight for Berlin, that the heart of the war would be won in the heart of Europe. And they believed that the British, in fact, were fixated on the Mediterranean for imperial reasons. The British, at this point, have dominated the Mediterranean for two centuries. And the Americans believe they're just trying to reassert their hegemony in the Mediterranean. So it's left up to Eisenhower. The Allies are kind of at loggerheads over what to do, and they tell Eisenhower to come up with a plan that is best devised to knock Italy from the war and to occupy as many German troops as possible in order to prevent them from reinforcing what will be the Normandy front. And so after Sicily falls, with the relatively successful campaign in 6 weeks, Eisenhower is feeling quite optimistic, and so he recommends going straight into Italy. It's right across the Strait of Messina. It seems relatively easy. And so this plan is approved by Washington and London, and the landings in Italy occur in September 1943. The British Eighth Army crosses the Strait of Messina into the toe of the boot of Italy under General Montgomery. And then the main force under General Clark lands at Salerno, which is about 40 miles south of Naples. The Italians capitulate instantly. Before the first soldier sets foot on the beach at Salerno, the Italians give up. So half of Eisenhower's marching order is fulfilled. But then the Germans, who have initially decided that they're going to give up southern Italy, change their minds, partly because of the success in resisting at Salerno, and they fight every inch of the way up the peninsula, as you said, for 608 days, 312,000 Allied casualties. It does remain controversial to this day.
Hmm. Let's talk with a couple of other listeners now. We go next to a listener on line 4 on a cell phone. Good afternoon.
Hello there. My father flew in Army Air Corps as a B-17 tail gunner throughout this campaign, and just was curious to know what emphasis or study you've done of their role in this whole campaign, and if you could speak to that, I'd be grateful. Thanks.
Sure. Thanks for the question. Thanks to your father for his service. You know, as I alluded to earlier, to some extent, the campaign in Italy was about airfields. We had an overwhelming superiority in aviation. That became even stronger as the war went on. You find the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, increasingly weak, and eventually they're not much of a force to be reckoned with in Italy at all. So the effort to go into mainland Italy, first Sicily and then mainland Italy, is in part to establish airfields. And nobody can build airfields like the United States Army Air Corps. They can knock out the Army Air Forces. They can knock out an airfield in a matter of hours. And so you find a constellation of airfields around Foggia, which is to the east of Naples. And those are seized and expanded immediately after the landings. And so you find a very elaborate bombing campaign that begins out of Italy. 15th Air Force is created in November 1943 and intended to complement the bombing campaign that's going on from England with the American 8th Air Force and British Bomber Command. The effort is to, in effect, triangulate strategic targets in Central Europe. And so the Americans and British from Italy are bombing ball bearing plants, they're bombing oil facilities, they're bombing cities in Central Europe, including Germany, and the same is happening with the 8th Army. It didn't go as easily as some had hoped, partly because the weather in Italy is not as sunny and bright as some people had believed it might be. The weather in Italy, of course, can be pretty nasty in the winter, especially if you're flying over the Alps. And this turned out to restrict the number of missions that were flown. It tended to obscure targets. They had to bomb secondary targets. Nevertheless, it's an important part of the pressure that's being put on the Reich in particular. It's an important part of the pressure that's being put on the German occupation of Italy, because a lot of targets are not on the north side of the Alps. They're in northern Italy. That's where most of the Italian industry that the Germans are using for their own war efforts is located. You know, what you find in anybody who's looked carefully at, say, B-17 crews, they're amazingly brave. And the life expectancy of a B-17 crew flying out of England and, to some extent, flying out of Italy can be measured in a matter of days. It's a very hazardous thing to do, because especially when you get over Germany, the German fighters and German anti-aircraft defenses are extraordinarily robust and fatal for, as it turns out, thousands and thousands of flyers. You know, the Army Air Forces is an important and ultimately a war-winning part of this whole campaign.
Mm. Let's take another call now. A listener in Hoopston, line one. Hi.
Yeah, hi, Celeste. Thanks for taking my call. I just tuned in, so apologize if this was already covered. A quick question I'll ring off. The landing in Italy at one of the beaches, and I apologize because I don't think I have the name right. I want to say Anzio, but I'm probably wrong. Wasn't it a monumental mistake by the commander at that time, where the landing was relatively easy, and instead of advancing, he sat for several days and then just ran into the teeth of a battle? And I was wondering if you could speak to the logic behind the waiting, and if, in fact, that was a mistake. And I'll go ahead and listen. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for that. We did touch on that earlier. There was a caller from Chicago who asked about that, about General Lucas's decision not to push inland right after the landings were made on January 22nd, 1944. The truth is, as I said earlier, that General Lucas probably did the right thing. He was roundly criticized at the time, really, and has been criticized subsequently for not being more audacious in pushing inland. He had a very small force. He had a light corps, two divisions. The British division was under strength. The American 3rd Division was full strength, but nevertheless, the Germans very quickly moved reinforcements around the Anzio bridgehead. General Lucas had been given contradictory orders from his superiors, including General Clark, who's his immediate superior. Clark said, "Johnny, don't stick your neck out. I did that at Salerno, and look what happened to me." Clark almost was thrown back into the Tyrrhenian Sea at Salerno. And so Clark had warned Lucas to exercise caution, and Lucas was by nature a cautious guy. And so what you find, and Lucas kept a very detailed diary, so we know his anxieties before, during, and after Anzio, You find Lucas essentially ordering his forces to stay put. They expand about 7 miles inland, but by the time he's ready to move in force, it's about a week after the landings, the Germans have become so strong that his efforts to break out of the bridgehead are a failure. And the Rangers, who are there under Colonel William Darby, have 3 battalions who are leading the breakout effort in front of the 3rd Division, commanded by Lucien Truscott. They walk into an ambush. 2 Ranger battalions are essentially destroyed. The 3rd one is badly battered. The rest of the effort to break out goes badly, and Lucas ends up hunkering down and then withstanding a ferocious German counteroffensive in the middle of February, about 3 weeks after the landings. So Lucas has taken a lot of heat. He lost his job. He left in not disgrace, but in some humiliation subsequently. And, you know, I think that most generals who've looked at this subsequently, including Clark and including George Marshall and others, believe that Lucas ended up doing the right thing. But he, you know, has remained a controversial figure, as so many from the Italian campaign have in the 60-some years since.
Thanks for the call. Other questions are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Maybe you would talk with us just a little bit. There's so much here, but a little bit about the accomplishments of Lieutenant General Mark Clark and Major General Lucien Truscott. Tell us a little bit about these two men.
Sure. They're two of my favorite characters, partly because they're so dissimilar. Mark Clark is West Point class of 1917. He's 2 years behind Eisenhower at West Point. They're in the same company where they have been friends, and they remain friends through the long interwar years, helping each other in their respective careers. Clark is a physically imposing presence. He's 6'3" with a huge wingspan. He towers over everyone. He's very aloof. He's got a big brain. He's fundamentally insecure. He is preoccupied with his public image. In Italy, he ultimately has a public relations staff that numbers 50 soldiers. Every release that comes out of Fifth Army headquarters refers to Fifth Army as Lieutenant General Mark W. Clark's Fifth Army. And this rubs a lot of people the wrong way, including George Marshall, who is the antithesis of this kind of self-centered self-promotion. I think what you find, and he remains an extraordinarily controversial figure, Mark Clark does. The British, for the most part, can't stand him. If you go to Texas, and I was just in Texas, they can't stand him. They hold Clark responsible for an order of the for the 36th Infantry Division, which had been the Texas National Guard, to attack across the Rapido River in January 1944. It was a debacle. There were more than 2,000 casualties. They hold Clark responsible. His name is Mud in Texas. He's very attentive to logistics, which is important. We talked about how Patton was not. He cares a lot about the welfare of his men. He's personally brave. He's nearly killed a couple of times in Italy because he's often at the front. He's impossible to love. He's impossible for some people to even like. My ambition is to make him interesting, and I find he's really interesting. And you can see a lot about a man under stress in the letters that he writes to his wife, and Clark's to his wife, Maureen, are at the Citadel. He was the president of the Citadel in South Carolina after the war. And you can see that Clark is a tormented character in some ways. Lucien Truscott is a two-star general. When he comes into the campaign in Sicily, commands the 3rd Infantry Division, which today is in Iraq. He is born to lead other men in the dark of night. He is a natural combat commander, one of the most extraordinary field commanders that the Army has during World War II. Sort of unusual background. He's born in Texas. He spent 6 years before he joined the cavalry as a young man teaching in one-room schoolhouses, mostly in Oklahoma. And the schoolmaster aspect never really left him. You find him chiding subordinates for using the passive voice too much, for example. He's got a fine tactical eye. He's fundamentally selfless. Again, you see, he's a fine writer, and the letters to his wife, Sarah, who's from Virginia, which are at the George Marshall Library in Virginia today, are very revealing of him. The letters always begin, "Beloved wife," and you can see that this is an exceptional sensibility. He is frequently beset with various maladies. He's a heavy smoker, so he's constantly having his throat painted with silver nitrate. His throat's always inflamed. He's got toothaches periodically. He's got nasal polyps. He's wounded at Anzio. A shell goes off and wounds him in the leg, so he's hobbling around. Nevertheless, he's a very tough guy, and he fights through this. And what you see is Truscott rising to the top, and he'll be a large figure in the invasion of southern Europe, and he will go back and ultimately replace Clark as the senior American commander in Italy. And what you see in the Mediterranean generally, both in North Africa and then Sicily and Italy, is a sorting out, a sifting of the competent from the incompetent, the capable from the incapable, the lucky from the unlucky, which is important in war. And Truscott is someone who rises to the top by virtue of being as competent as he is.
Mm. One of the journalists covering the war that you quote in this book is a fellow by the name of Don Whitehead. And among the things he wrote about war is this: "Every time I have watched troops plod into battle, I have choked back a desire to sob." What would you like to say about the soldiers, the troops who did the fighting?
Well, the troops who did the fighting obviously are the heart and soul of the story. First, I think, you know, what you have to say is that, you know, they are us. It's an army that's largely drafted. It's a military that grows to 16 million. This is in a country of 137 million. It's a force that is, you know, largely white, almost exclusively male, that is deeply segregated, and from every walk of life. If you look at the Princeton class of, I think it's 1940, you find that the valedictorian and the salutatorian of that Princeton class were enlisted men in the war. Not only are there a lot of Princetonians serving, which is something you don't find today much, but they're serving in lower ranks. I think the extraordinary thing that you see when you're looking at World War II is a country that is completely and totally at war, that all 137 million are somehow involved in the war to an extent that is almost unimaginable today. The shopkeeper, the woman who's been a homemaker and suddenly finds herself working in an aircraft factory in Detroit because she's needed to help build aircraft. The butcher, baker, and candlestick maker, they are all at war somehow. Mm. If you look at a Time magazine or Life magazine, say from the third week of November 1943, you see in every page of those magazines, from the news at the front to the back of the book reviews to all of the ads, a country that is swept up in war. And I think that is hard for people to imagine these days when we have 300 million of us and the two wars that we're fighting now are almost exclusively fought by those in the military and their families, a relatively small portion of the larger population, and the rest of us are told to go shopping more. So I think that is, part of the... not only the nature of World War II, it's something that requires an exercise of imagination when you're looking back six decades to appreciate appreciate quite how fully this nation, when it's told that it's facing an existential crisis, how we react, how we participate, and so on.
Yeah. In conjunction with the broadcast of Ken Burns' documentary series, The War, our stations have been recording stories of veterans, and some of them served in Italy. And Harriet Williamson, my producer, actually interviewed two of these gentlemen. And I'd like to, before we run out of time, maybe play a cut or two from these folks. You spoke about luck and unluck, being lucky and unlucky. I'd like to play an excerpt from an interview with a fellow who was born in a little community here in central Illinois, Villa Grove, Charles Bruns. He was a staff sergeant with the 3rd Infantry Division, 110th Engineers Battalion. And he has a story of what it was like in Sicily during the invasion. Let's hear it.
There's another thing, too, that people don't know about. On the invasion of Sicily, the 101st Airborne was coming in for a parachute drop. We got the word that it was Germans dropping parachutes. And believe it or not, we shot up our own men coming in there on Sicily. I mean, it was a fiasco. That was all there was to it. That was really, because there's the whole thing. You see, somebody just got something crossed, and they said that they were dropping German paratroopers in on us. And when they did that, well, that was poor 101st lost an awful lot of men and planes by being shot down like that.
Yeah. You want to comment on that?
No, Celeste, I have to tell you, I couldn't hear that for some reason.
Oh.
Some reason, sadly, all I heard was dead air.
Oh, well, he tells
this. I can't comment on it.
He tells this story of being on the ground, and there are paratroopers coming in, and they've been told, he and his fellows have been told on the ground that they're Germans who are coming in.
Uh-huh.
So they're firing on.
Firing on themselves.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a famous and very sad episode. It's one of the worst episodes of fratricide or friendly fire in World War II. It's in Sicily. It's early in the invasion, and Patton has ordered a regiment from the 82nd Airborne to be flown in from North Africa and to jump to reinforce this shallow beachhead on the southern coast of Sicily. The forces that are on the beach and at sea, and the ships that are close to the beach, have been under attack by the Germans and German planes all day long and into the evening. And when this fleet of airplanes suddenly appears overhead, the word has not been sufficiently circulated that these are our forces coming in, and someone, no one knows who, opened fire. And it became contagious, and this single spurt of machine gun fire turned into a general firing that stretched almost the length of the beachhead for 50 miles and extended it some depth to sea, with ships firing also. 23 planes were shot down. Mm. Hundreds of paratroopers and aircraft crewmen were killed. It was a calamity of the first order, as you can imagine. Patton had misgivings about this, about whether, in fact, the word had been distributed properly, and had thought about calling it off, but it was too late. The planes were already in the air. When you look back on it, you say, how could they have been so foolish as to think that you could fly this armada over jumpy, trigger-happy troops and not have something like this happen? Well, it's an example of how the force is fundamentally green still, despite at this point 7 months of combat in North Africa. There's still a lot of greenness to get out, and this is one example of that. And those who participated in that evening in Sicily never forgot it. It really seared itself into the minds of everyone, whether you were in the air or on the ground.
Yeah. I want to play another short clip now, and fingers crossed, we think you can hear this one.
Okay.
This is of a veteran. His name, Ralph Wagner Woolard. He was in intelligence, and he served with the 36th Infantry Division, 142nd Regiment, 3rd Battalion. He served from April 43 to October of 45. He's a veteran of Monte Cassino. And he was wounded twice during his service. And here he talks about the civilians at Cassino. Let's listen to this.
On one occasion, at the Cassino front, the Germans pushed through a group of Italians. Now, the Germans didn't want to take care of them. They said, let the Americans take care of them. They pushed them through the lines, and they happened to come through my platoon and company area. And these were men and women and children. Mm-hmm. And I saw two men without shoes. And it was snowing. We didn't have much we could give them, mm-hmm. except to direct them on down to the base of the mountain. But the civilians suffered, and there's no question about it. The Italian people had very little stomach for that war. Mm-hmm. Mussolini was, they had little respect for him after the war started.
And here we have, you know, the terrible price that the mm-hmm. Italians paid, the civilians paid.
Yeah, that's very affecting. He's right, the Italian civilians suffered horribly. The hot rake of war, as Churchill called it, was in fact dragged up the length of the Italian boot. You know, there was limited sympathy, as you can imagine, early on, because Italy had been a fascist partner of the Germans. The Italians had participated in overseas adventurism. They'd acted with aggression in Africa. They had started the campaign in Greece. There were a lot of Italians that fought beside the Germans in Russia, and a lot of Italians who died at Stalingrad. The Italian people generally, you know, had been hugely supportive of Mussolini from the early 20s when he took power on into the 30s, believing that he had famously made the trains run on time and done a number of other things. But by the time we're coming into the war as an Allied participant, the Italians are sick of war, and they've suffered very large losses. It's clear that the Italian military is second rate, what's left of it, and you can see by the poor performance of the Italians defending Sicily, their own homeland, that they didn't have much stomach for it. And so one of the most interesting parts of this whole campaign is the secret negotiation with a lot of skullduggery and meetings in places like Lisbon between emissaries from Eisenhower and emissaries from the Italian government over the Italian surrender. And, of course, the Allies are insisting that it be unconditional surrender. Mussolini is arrested on the orders of the king. He's in jail, moved around several times. Hitler, who actually admires, and Mussolini's about as close a friend as he's got, orders commandos to rescue Mussolini in very daring fashion. They land on a mountaintop called Gran Sasso by glider without firing a shot. They spirit Mussolini away from his captors. So it's a very dramatic story, including the final decision under much duress by the Italian government with the king's approval to agree to surrender. And the surrender, as I mentioned earlier, occurred right on the eve of the invasion at Salerno, and the Italians think the war's over. Well, the war's only begun for them in a meaningful way.
Yeah.
And the casualties that the Italian civilians suffer, the number of Italian towns, the destruction of Naples, for example, is extraordinary.
Yeah. We have to wrap up here. The final question would be, given all of this horror and the terrible price of the campaigns for Sicily and the campaign for Italy, Did it eventually, though, aid the effort in Normandy?
I think the short answer to that is yes. The question is how much. There were about 26 or 27 German divisions, or the equivalent of that, fighting in Italy. So that's 26 divisions that you don't have in Normandy. The Germans, for example, had 175 divisions on the Eastern Front fighting the Russians. So you can see it's relative, and the Italian contribution is not inconsequential, but it's relatively small. We talked earlier about the bombing campaign that was launched out of Italy. That was important.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about the experience and expertise that's gained through these earlier campaigns, including Sicily and Italy. That's important. Dwight Eisenhower leaves Italy. He leaves the Mediterranean on December 31st, 1943, to go on to, you know, his peculiar fate as commander of the force landing in Normandy. And he has learned a lot. He's taken a great deal away from his experiences in the Mediterranean, and there are others like that, too. So I think, you know, if you say, was this vital to success in Normandy and beyond, the answer to that is it's probably not vital. We probably could have landed in Normandy. We probably would have won the war. But certainly it's contributory, and it's an important and vital part of our history. It's an important and vital part of the liberation of Europe. I mean, look what we did for Italy. Italy has become a trusted ally of a democracy of the first order after their own fashion, and you know, an extraordinary market economy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think you can say that there were things born out of the Italian campaign that were important to the war. And in some respects, even more important things that were born from that campaign that were important to the peace that's endured for 60 years since.
There we've got to leave it. Rick Atkinson, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste.
Rick Atkinson is the author of An Army at Dawn and The Day of Battle. They are part of his Liberation Trilogy, the first and second books in that trilogy. The books are published by Henry Holt. And my thanks this afternoon to the veterans, as well as to Harriet Williamson and Mike Pritchard for helping us produce those spots from the veterans.